arms, and this would make it impossible to bear for the Norwegian traders, who already had difficult conditions. Among the peasantry, the rumor of King Magnus' secret sin still held sway, and many of the parish priests in the countryside and the wandering monks were agreed about at least one thing. They believed this was the reason that St. Olav's church in Nidaros had burned. The farmers also blamed this sin for the many misfortunes that had befallen one village after another over the past few years. Sickness in the livestock, blight in the crops, which brought illness and disease to both people and beasts, and poor harvests of grain and hay. Erland said that if the Hoftersons had been wise enough to hold their peace a little longer and acquire a reputation for amenable and chieftain-like conduct, then people might have remembered that they too were grandsons of King Haakon. Eventually this unrest died down, but the result was that the king appointed Ivar Ogmundsson as Lord Chancellor in Norway. Erling Vidkunsson, Stig Haakonsson, the Hoftersons, and all their supporters were threatened with charges of treason. Then they yielded and came to make peace with the king. There was a powerful man from the uplands whose name was Ulf Saxason. He had taken part in the Hoftersons' opposition, and he did not make peace with the king, but came instead to Nidaros after Christmas. He spent a great deal of time with Erland in town, and from him the people of the north heard about the matters, as Ulf perceived them. Kristin had a great dislike for this man. She didn't know him, but she knew his sister Helga Saxe's daughter, who was married to Gerd Dare of Difrin. She was beautiful but exceedingly arrogant, and Simon didn't care for her either, although Romborg got along well with her. Soon after the beginning of Lent, letters arrived for the sheriff stating that Ulf Saxason was to be declared an outlaw at the Tings, but by that time he had already sailed away from Norway in midwinter. That spring, Erland and Kristin were staying at their town estate during Easter, and they had brought their youngest son, Munan, with them, because there was a sister at the Bakke convent who was so skilled in healing that every sick child she touched regained health, as long as it was not God's wish for the child to die. One day shortly after Easter, Kristin came home from the convent with the infant. The manservant and maid who had accompanied her came with her into the house. Erland was alone, lying on one of the benches. After the manservant left, and the women had taken off their cloaks, Kristin sat near the hearth with the child while the maid heated some oil, which the nun had given them. Then Erland asked from his place on the bench what Sister Ronhild had said about the boy. Kristin replied brusquely to his questions as she unwrapped the swaddling clothes. Finally, she stopped talking altogether. "Are things so bad with the boy, Kristin, that you don't want to tell me?" he asked with some impatience. "You've asked the same things before, Erland," replied his wife in a cold voice. "And I've answered you many times. But since you care so little about the boy that you can't remember from one day to the next..." "It has also happened to me, Kristin," said Erland as he stood up and went over to her, "that I've had to give you the same answer two or three times to some question you've asked me, because you didn't bother to remember what I'd said."
"It was probably not about such important matters as the children's health," she said in the same cold voice.
"But it wasn't about petty things either this past winter. They were matters that weighed heavily on my mind."
"That's not true, Erland. It's been a long time since you talked to me about those things that were most on your mind."
"Leave us now, Sina," said Erland to the maid. His brow was flushed red as he turned to his wife. "I know what you're referring to. But I won't speak to you about that as long as your maid might hear me. Even though you're such good friends with her that you think it a small matter for her to be present when you start a quarrel with your husband and say I'm not speaking the truth."
"One learns least from the people one lives with," said Kristin curtly.
"It's not easy to understand what you mean by that. I've never spoken unkindly to you in the presence of strangers, or forgotten to show you honor and respect in front of our servants."
Kristin burst into an oddly desolate and quavering laugh. "You forget so well, Erland. Ulf Haldorsson has lived with us all these years. Don't you remember when you had him and Hofdor bring me to you in the bedchamber of Brynhild's house in Oslo? Erland sank down onto the bench, staring at his wife with his mouth agape. But she continued, "You never thought it necessary to conceal from your servants all that was improper or disrespectful here at Husaby or anywhere else, whether it was something shameful for yourself or for your wife." Erland stayed where he was, looking at her aghast. "Do you remember that first winter of our marriage? I was carrying Nakva, and as things stood, it seemed likely that it would be difficult for me to demand obedience and respect from my household. Do you remember how you supported me? Do you remember when your foster father visited us with women guests we didn't know, and his maids and serving men and our own servants sat across the table from us? Do you remember how Munan pulled from me every shred of dignity I might use to hide behind, and you sat there meekly and dared not stop his speech? Jesus, have you been brooding about this for 15 years? Then he looked up at her. His eyes seemed such a strange pale blue, and his voice was faltering and helpless. "And yet, my Kristen, it doesn't seem to me that the two of us say unkind or harsh words to each other." "No," said Kristen, "and that's why it cut even deeper into my heart that time during the Christmas celebration when you railed at me because I had spread my cape over Margaret, while women from 3 counties stood around and listened." Erland did not reply. "And yet you blame me for the way things went with Margaret. But every time I tried to reprimand her with even a single word, she would run to you, and you would tell me sternly to leave the maiden in peace. She was yours and not mine."
"Blame you? No, I don't," Erland said with difficulty, struggling hard to speak calmly. "If one of our children had been a daughter, then you might have better understood how this matter of my daughter, it stabs a father to the very marrow."
"I thought I showed you this spring that I understood," said his wife softly. "I only had to think of my own father."
"All the same, this was much worse," said Erland, his voice still calm. "I was an unmarried man. This man was married. I was not bound. At least," he corrected himself, "I wasn't bound in such a way that I couldn't free myself."
"And yet you didn't free yourself," said Kristen. "Don't you remember how it came about that you were freed?"
Erland leaped to his feet and slapped her face. Then he stood staring at her in horror. A red patch appeared on her white cheek, but she sat rigid and motionless, her eyes hard. The child began to cry in fright. She rocked him gently in her arms, hushing him.
"That was a vile thing to say, Kristen," said her husband uncertainly.
"The last time you struck me," she answered in a low voice, "I was carrying your child under my heart. Now you hit me as I hold your son on my lap."
"Yes, we keep having all these children," he shouted impatiently.
They both fell silent. Erland began swiftly pacing back and forth. She carried the child over to the alcove and put him on the bed. When she reappeared in the alcove doorway, he stopped in front of her.
I shouldn't have struck you, my Kristen. I wish I hadn't done it. I'll probably regret it for as long as I regretted it the first time. But you've told me before that you think I forget things too quickly. But you never forget. Not a single injustice I might have done you. I've tried to be a good husband to you. But you don't seem to think that worth remembering. You're so beautiful, Kristen."
He gazed after her as she walked past him. Oh, his wife's quiet and dignified bearing was as lovely as the willowy grace of the young maiden had been. She was wider in the bosom and hips, but she was also taller. She held herself erect, and her neck bore the small, round head as proudly and beautifully as ever. Her pale, remote face with the dark gray eyes stirred and excited him as much as her round, rosy child's face
had stirred and excited his restless soul with its wondrous calm. He went over and took her hand.
"For me, Kristen, you will always be the most beautiful of women, and the most dear."
She allowed him to hold her hand but didn't squeeze his in return. Then he flung it aside. Rage overcame him once again.
"You say I've forgotten. That may not always be the worst of sins. I've never pretended to be a pious man, but I remember what I learned from Sarah Yon when I was a child, and God's servants have reminded me of it since. It's a sin to brood over and dwell on the sins we have confessed to the priest and repented before God, receiving his forgiveness through the hand and the words of the priest. And it's not out of piety, Kristen, that you're constantly tearing open these old sins of ours. You want to hold the knife to my throat every time I oppose you in some way."
He walked away and then came back,
domineering. "God knows that I love you, Kristen, even though I can see how domineering you are. And you've never forgiven me for the injustice I did to you or for luring you astray. I've tolerated a great deal from you, Kristen, but I will no longer tolerate the fact that I can never have peace from these old misfortunes, nor that you speak to me as if I were your thrall."
Kristen was trembling with fury when she spoke.
"I've never spoken to you as if you were my thrall. Have you ever heard me speak harshly or in anger to anyone who might be considered lesser than me, even if it was the most incompetent or worthless of our household servants? I know that before God I am free of the sin of offending his poor in either word or deed. But you're supposed to be my Lord. I'm supposed to obey and honor you, bow to you and lean on you, next to God, in accordance with God's laws, Erlan. And if I've lost patience and talked to you in a manner unbefitting a wife speaking to her husband, then it's because many times you've made it difficult for me to surrender my ignorance to your better understanding, to honor and obey my husband and Lord as much as I would have liked. And perhaps I had expected that you, perhaps I thought I could provoke you into showing me that you were a man and I was only a poor woman. But you needn't worry, Erlan. I will not offend you again with my words. And from this day forward, I will never forget to speak to you as gently as if you were descended from thralls."
Erlan's face had flushed dark red. He raised his fist at her, then turned swiftly on his heel, grabbed his cape and sword from the bench near the door, and rushed out. It was sunny outside, with a piercing wind. The air was cold, but glistening particles of thawing ice sprayed over him from the building eaves and from the swaying tree branches. The snow on the rooftops gleamed like silver, and beyond the black-green forested slopes surrounding the town, the mountain peaks sparkled icy blue and shiny white in the sharp, dazzling light of the wintry spring day. Erlan raced through the streets and alleyways, fast but aimless. He was boiling inside. She was wrong. It was clear that she had been wrong from the very beginning. And he was right. He had allowed himself to be provoked and struck her, undercutting his position. But she was the one who was wrong. Now he had no idea what to do with himself. He had no wish to visit any acquaintances, and he refused to go back home. There was a great tumult in town. A large trading ship from Iceland, the first of the spring season, had put in at the docks that morning. Erlan wandered west through the lanes and emerged near St. Martin's Church. He headed down toward the wharves. There were already shrieks and clamor coming from the inns and alehouses, even though it was early afternoon. In his youth, Erlan could have gone into such places himself, along with friends and companions. But now people would stare, wide-eyed, and afterwards they would wear out their gums gossiping if the sheriff of Orkdarla County, who had a residence in town and ale, mead, and wine in abundance in his own home, should go into an inn and ask for a taste of their paltry ale. But that was truly what he wished for most, to sit and drink with the smallholders who had come to town and with the servants and seamen. No one would make a fuss if these fellows gave their women a slap in the face. It would do them good. How in fiery hell was a man to rule his wife if he couldn't beat her because of her high birth and his own sense of honor? The devil himself couldn't compete with a woman through words. She was a witch, but so beautiful. If only he could beat her until she gave in. The bells began to ring from all the churches in town, calling the people to vespers. The sounds tumbled in the spring wind, hovering over him in the turbulent air. No doubt she was on her way to Christchurch now, that holy witch. She would complain to God and the Virgin Mary and Saint Olaf that she had been struck in the face by her husband. Erland sent his wife's guardian saints a greeting of sinful thoughts as the bells resounded and tolled and clanged. He headed towards St. Gregor's church. The graves of his parents lay in front of St. Anna's altar in the north aisle of the nave. As Erland said his prayers, he noticed that Fru Suniva Olav's daughter and her maid had entered the church portal. When he finished praying, he went over to greet her. In all the years he had known Fru Suniva, things had always been such between them that they could banter and jest quite freely whenever they met. On this evening, as they sat on the bench and waited for evensong to begin, he grew so bold that several times she had to remind him that they were in church, with people constantly coming in. "Yes, yes," said Erland, "but you're so lovely tonight, Suniva. It's wonderful to banter with a woman who has such gentle eyes."
"You're not worthy enough, Erland Nikolausen, for me to look at you with gentle eyes," she said, laughing.
"Then I'll come and banter with you after it grows dark," replied Erland in the same tone of voice. "When the mass is over, I'll escort you home."
At that moment, the priests entered the choir, and Erland went over to the south nave to join the other men. When the service came to an end, he left the church through the main door. He saw Fru Suniva and her maid a short distance down the street. He thought it best he didn't accompany her and go right home instead. Just then a group of Icelanders from the trading ship appeared in the street, staggering and clinging to each other, and seemed intent on blocking the way of the two women. Erland ran after them. As soon as the seamen saw a gentleman with a sword on his belt approaching, they stepped aside and made room for the women to pass.
"I think it would be best if I escorted you home after all," said Erland. "There's too much unrest in town tonight."
"What do you think, Erland? As old as I am? And yet, perhaps it doesn't displease me if a few men still find me pretty enough to try to block my passage."
There was only one answer that a courteous man could give. He returned to his own residence at dawn the next morning, pausing for a moment outside the bolted door to the main building, frozen, dead tired, heartsick, and dejected. Should he pound on the door to wake the servants, and then slip inside to crawl into bed next to Kristen, who lay there with the child at her breast? No. He had with him the key to the eastern storehouse loft. That's where he kept some possessions that were in his charge. Erland unlocked the door, pulled off his boots, and spread some homespun fabric and empty sacks on top of the straw in the bed. He wrapped his cape around him, crept under the sacks, and was fortunate enough to fall asleep and forget everything, exhausted and confused as he was. Kristen was pale and weary from a sleepless night as she sat down to breakfast with her servants. One of the men said he had asked the master to come to the table. He was sleeping in the east loft, but Erland told him to go to the devil. Erland was supposed to go to Elgesetter after the morning service to be a witness to the sale of several estates. Afterwards, he managed to excuse himself from the meal in the refectory and to slip away from Arne Jalvaldsen, who had also declined to stay and drink with the brothers, but wanted Erland to come home to Ranheim with him. Later, he regretted that he had parted company with the others, and he was filled with dread as he walked home alone through town. Now he would have to think about what he had done. For a moment, he was tempted to go straight down to St. Gregor's church. He had promised to make confession to one of the priests whenever he was in Nidaros. But if he did it again, after he had confessed, it would be an even greater sin. He had better wait for a while.
Suniva must think he was little better than a chicken she had caught with her bare hands. But no, the devil take him if he'd ever thought a woman would be able to teach him so many new things. Here he was walking around and gasping with astonishment at what he had encountered. He had imagined himself to be rather experienced in Ars Amoris, or whatever the learned men called it. If he had been young and green, he would probably have felt quite cocky and thought it splendid. But he didn't like that woman, that wild woman. He was sick of her. He was sick of all women except his own wife, and he was sick of her as well. By the Holy Cross, he had been so married to her that he had grown pious himself because he had believed in her piety. But what a handsome reward he had been given by his pious wife for his faithfulness and love, witch that she was. He remembered the sting of her spiteful words from the evening before. So she thought he acted as if he were descended from thralls. And that other woman, Suniva, no doubt thought he was inexperienced and clumsy because he had been caught off guard and showed some surprise at her skills and love. Now he would show her that he was no more a saint than she was. He had promised her to come to Bardsgard that night, and he might as well go. He had committed the sin. He might as well enjoy the pleasure that it offered. He had already broken his vows to Kristen, and she herself was to blame, with her spiteful and unreasonable behavior toward him. He went home and wandered through the stables and outbuildings, looking for something to complain about. He quarreled with the priest's servant from the hospital because she had brought malt into the drying room, even though he knew that his own servants had no use for the grain-drying house when they were in Nidaros. He wished that his sons were with him. They would have been good company. He wished he could go back home to Husaby at once, but he had to stay in Nidaros and wait for letters to arrive from the south. It was too risky to receive such letters at his own home in the village. The mistress of the house didn't come to the evening meal. She was lying in bed in the alcove, said her maid Sina, with a reproachful look at her master. Erland replied harshly that he hadn't asked about her mistress. After the servants had left the room, he went into the alcove. It was oppressively dark. Erland bent over Kristen on the bed. "Are you crying?" he asked very softly, for her breathing sounded so strange. But she answered brusquely that she wasn't. "Are you tired?" "I'm about to go to bed, too," he murmured. Kristen's voice quavered as she said, "Then I would rather, Erland, that you went to bed in the same place where you slept last night." Erland didn't reply. He went out and then returned with the candle from the hall and opened up his clothes chest. He was already dressed suitably enough to go out wherever he liked, for he was wearing the violet-blue cotardi because he had been to Elgasetter in the morning. But now he took off these garments, slowly and deliberately, and put on a red silk shirt and a mouse-gray calf-length velvet tunic with small silver bells on the points of the sleeves. He brushed his hair and washed his hands, all the while keeping his eyes on his wife. She was silent and didn't move. Then he left without bidding her good night. The next day, he openly returned home to the estate at breakfast time. This went on for a week. Then one evening, when Erland came back home after going up to Hungrar on business, he was told that Kristen had set off for Husaby that morning. He was already quite aware that no man had ever had less pleasure from a sin than he was having from his dealings with Suniva Olav's daughter. In his heart he was so unbearably tired of that demented woman, sick of her even as he played with her and caressed her. He had also been reckless. It must be known all over town and throughout the countryside by now that he had been spending his nights at Bardsgard. And it was not worth having his reputation sullied for Suniva's sake. Occasionally he also wondered whether there might be consequences. After all, the woman had a husband, such as he was, decrepit and sickly. He pitied Bard for being married to such a wanton and foolish woman. Erland was hardly the first to tread too close to the man's honor. And Hoftor. But when he took up with Suniva, he hadn't remembered that she was Hofdor's sister. He didn't think of this until it was too late. The situation was as bad as it could possibly be. And now he realized that Kristen knew about it. Surely she wouldn't think of bringing a charge against him before the Archbishop, seeking permission to leave him. She had Jorungard to flee to, but it would be impossible for her to travel over the mountains at this time of year. Even more so if she wanted to take the children along, and Kristen would never leave them behind. He reassured himself that she wouldn't be able to travel by ship with Munan and Lavran so early in the spring. No, it would be unlike Kristen to seek help from the Archbishop against him. She had reason to do so, but he would willingly stay away from their bed until she understood that he felt true remorse. Kristen would never allow this matter to become a public case. Yet he realized it had been a long time since he could be certain what his wife might or might not do. That night he lay in his own bed, letting his thoughts roam. It occurred to him that he had acted with even greater folly than he had first thought when he entered into this miserable affair, now that he was involved in the greatest plans. He cursed himself for still being such a fool over a woman that she could drive him to this. He cursed both Kristen and Suniva. By devil. He was no more besotted with women than other men. He had gotten involved with fewer of them than most of the men he knew. But it was as if the fiend himself were after him. He couldn't come near a woman without landing in mire up to his armpits. It had to be stopped now. Thank the Lord he had other matters on his hands. Soon, very soon, he would receive Lady Ingeborg's letters. Well, he couldn't avoid trouble with women in this matter either, but that must be God's punishment for the sins of his youth. Erland laughed out loud in the dark. Lady Ingeborg would have to see that what they had told her about the situation was true. The question was whether it would be one of her sons or the sons of her unlawful sister whom the Norwegians supported to oppose King Magnus. And she loved the children she had borne to Knut Portia in a way she had never loved her other children. Soon, very soon. Then it would be the sharp wind and the salty waves that would fill his embrace. God in heaven, it would be good to be soaked through by the sea swells and feel the fresh wind seep into his marrow. To be quit of women for a good long time. Suniva. Let her think what she would. He wouldn't go back there again. And Kristen could go off to Jorungard if she liked. It might be safest and best for her and the children to be far away in Gudbrandsdal this summer. Later on, he would no doubt make amends with her again. The following morning, he rode up toward Skaun. He decided he wouldn't have any peace until he knew what his wife intended to do. She received him politely, her demeanor gentle and cool, when he arrived at Husaby later in the day. Unless he asked her a question, she said not a word, not even anything unkind, and she didn't object when later that evening he came over and tentatively lay down in their bed. But when he had lain there for a while, he hesitantly tried to put his hand on her breast. Kristen's voice shook, but Erlan couldn't tell if it was from sorrow or bitterness when she whispered, "Surely you're not so lowly a man, Erlan, that you will make this even worse for me. I cannot start a quarrel with you, since our children are sleeping all around. And since I have 7 sons by you, I would rather our servants didn't see that I know I'm a woman who has been betrayed." Erlan lay there in silence for a long time before he dared reply. "Yes. May God have mercy on me, Kristen. I have betrayed you. I wouldn't have done it if I had found it easier to bear those vicious words you said to me in Nidaros. I haven't come home to beg your forgiveness, for I know this would be too much to ask of you right now."
"I see that Munan Bardson spoke the truth," replied his wife. "The day will never come when you will stand up and take the blame for what you have done. You should turn to God and seek redemption from him. You need to ask his forgiveness more than you need to ask mine."
"Yes, I know that," said Erlan bitterly. And then they said no more,
The next morning, he rode back to Nidaros. He had been in town several days when Fru Suniva's maid came to speak to him in St. Gregor's Church one evening. Erlan thought he ought to talk to Suniva one last time and told the girl to keep watch that night. He would come the same way as before. He had to creep and climb like a chicken thief to reach the loft where they always met. This time he felt sick with shame that he had made such a fool of himself, at his age and in his position. But in the beginning it had amused him to carry on like a youth. Fru Suniva received him in bed. "So you've finally come, at this late hour." She laughed and yawned. "Hurry up, my friend, and come to bed. We can talk later about where you've been all this time." Erlan didn't know what to do or how to tell her what was on his mind. Without thinking, he began to unfasten his clothing. "We've both been reckless, Suniva. I don't think it advisable that I stay here tonight." "Surely Bard must be expected home sometime," he said.
"Are you afraid of my husband?" teased Suniva. "You've seen for yourself that Bard didn't even prick up his ears when we flirted right in front of him. If he asks me whether you've been spending time here at the manor, I'll just convince him that it's the same old nonsense. He trusts me much too well."
"Yes, he does seem to trust you too well," laughed Erlan, digging his fingers into her fair hair and her firm white shoulders.
"Do you think so?"
She gripped his wrist.
"And do you trust your own wife? I was still a shy and virtuous maiden when Bard won me."
"We'll keep my wife out of this," said Erlan sharply, releasing her.
"Why is that? Does it seem to you less proper for us to talk about Kristin Lavron's daughter than about Sir Bard, my husband?"
Erlan clenched his teeth and refused to answer.
"You must be one of those men, Erlan," said Suniva scornfully, "who thinks you're so charming and handsome that a woman can hardly be blamed if her virtue is like fragile glass to you, when usually she's as strong as steel."
"I've never thought that about you," replied Erlan roughly.
Suniva's eyes glittered. "What did you want with me then, Erlan, since you have married so well?"
"I told you not to mention my wife."
"Your wife or my husband?"
"You were always the one who started talking about Bard, and you were the worst to ridicule him," said Erlan bitterly. "And if you didn't mock him in words, I'd like to know how dearly you held his honor when you took another man in your husband's place. She is not diminished by my misdeeds."
"Is that what you want to tell me? That you still love Kristin, even though you like me well enough to want to play with me?"
"I don't know how well I like you. You were the one who showed your affection for me."
"And Kristin doesn't care for your love," she sneered. "I've seen how tenderly she looks at you, Erlan."
"Be silent," he shouted. "Perhaps she knew how worthless I was," he said, his voice harsh and hateful. "You and I might be each other's equal."
"Is that it?" threatened Suniva. "Am I supposed to be the whip you use to punish your wife?"
Erlan stood there, breathing hard. "You could call it that. But you put yourself willingly into my hands."
"Take care," said Suniva, "that the whip doesn't turn back on you." She was sitting up in bed, waiting.
But Erlan made no attempt to argue or to make amends with his lover. He finished getting dressed and left without saying another word. He wasn't overly pleased with himself or with the way he had parted with Suniva. There was no honor in it for him. But it didn't matter now. At least he was rid of her. Chapter 4. During that spring and summer, they saw little of the master at home at Husaby. On those occasions when he did return to his manor, he and his wife behaved with courtesy and friendliness toward each other. Erlan didn't in any way try to breach the wall that she had now put up between them, even though he would often give her a searching look. Otherwise, he seemed to have much to think about outside his own home.
And he never inquired with a single word about the management of the estate. This was something his wife mentioned when, shortly after Holy Cross Day, he asked her whether she wanted to accompany him to Raumsdahl. He had business to tend to in the uplands. Perhaps she would like to take the children along, spend some time at Uhrengard, visit kinsmen and friends in the valley. But Kristin had no wish to do so under any circumstances. Erland was in Nidaros during the Law Ting and afterwards out in Orkadal. Then he returned home to Husaby but immediately began preparations for a journey to Björgvin. The Margigrin was anchored out at Niederholm, and he was only waiting for Hoftor Grout, who was supposed to sail with him. 3 days before St. Margareta's Day, the hay harvesting began at Husaby. It was the finest weather, and when the workers went back out into the meadows after the midday rest, Olav the overseer asked the children to come along. Kristin was up in the clothing chamber, which was on the second story of the armory. The house was built in such a fashion that an outside stair led up to this room and the exterior gallery running along the side. Projecting over it was the third floor, which could be reached only by means of a ladder through a hatchway inside the clothing chamber. It was standing open because Erland was up in the weapons loft. Kristin carried the fur cape that Erland wanted to take along on his sea voyage out to the gallery and began to shake it. Then she heard the thunder of a large group of horsemen, and a moment later she saw men come riding out of the forest on Gaudal Road. An instant later, Erland was standing at her side.
"Is it true what you said, Kristin? That the fire went out in the cookhouse this morning?"
"Yes. Gudrid knocked over the soup kettle. We'll have to borrow some embers from Sira Eilev."
Erland looked over at the parsonage. "No, he can't get mixed up in this. Gauta," he called softly to the boy dawdling under the gallery, picking up one rake after another, with little desire to go out to the hay harvesting. "Come up the stairs, but stop at the top, or they'll be able to see you."
Kristin stared at her husband. She'd never seen him look this way before. A taut, alert calm came over his voice and face as he peered south toward the road, and over his tall, supple body as he ran inside the loft and came back at once with a flat package wrapped in linen. He handed it to the boy.
"Put this inside your shirt, and pay attention to what I tell you. You must safeguard these letters. It's more important than you can possibly know, my Gauta. Put your rake over your shoulder and walk calmly across the fields until you reach the alder thickets. Keep to the bushes down by the woods. You know the place well, I know you do. And then sneak through the densest underbrush all the way over to Skjoldvikstad. Make sure that things are calm at the farm. If you notice any sign of unrest or strange men around, stay hidden. But if you're sure it's safe, then go down and give this to Ulf, if he's home. If you can't put the letters into his own hand, and you're sure that no one is near, then burn them as soon as you can. But take care that both the writing and the seals are completely destroyed, and that they don't fall into anyone's hands but Ulf's. May God help us, my son. These are weighty matters to put into the hands of a boy only 10 winters old. Many a good man's life and welfare. Do you understand how important this is, Gauta?"
"Yes, father. I understand everything you said."
Gauta lifted his small, fair face with a somber expression as he stood on the stairs.
"If Ulf isn't home, tell Isak that he has to set off at once for Hevne and ride all night. He must tell them, and he knows who I mean, that I think a headwind has sprung up here, and that I fear my journey has now been cursed. Do you understand?"
"Yes, father. I remember everything you've told me."
"Go then. May God protect you, my son."
Erland dashed up to the weapons loft and was about to close the hatchway, but Kristin was already halfway through the opening. He waited until she had climbed up, then shut the hatch and ran over to a chest and took out several boxes of letters. He tore off the seals and stomped them to bits on the floor. He ripped the parchments into shreds and wrapped them around a key and tossed the whole thing out the window to the ground, where it landed in the tall nettles growing behind the building. With his hands on the windowsill, Erland stood and watched the small boy who was walking along the edge of the grain field toward the meadow,
where the rows of harvest workers were toiling with scythes and rakes. When Gauta disappeared into the little grove of trees between the field and the meadow, Erlan pulled the window closed. The sound of hoofbeats was now loud and close to the manor. Erlan turned to face his wife.
If you can retrieve what I threw outside just now, let Skula do it. He's a clever boy. Tell him to fling it into the ravine behind the cowshed. They'll probably be watching you, and maybe the older boys as well. But I don't think they would search you.
He tucked the broken pieces of seal inside her bodice.
They can't be recognized anymore, but even so.
Are you in some kind of danger, Erlan?
Kristen asked. As he looked down at her face, he threw himself into her open arms. For a moment, he held her tight.
I don't know, Kristen. We'll find out soon enough. Tora Eindridsson is riding in the lead, and I saw that Sir Bard is with them. I don't expect that Tora is coming here for any good purpose.
Now the horsemen had entered the courtyard. Erland hesitated for a moment. Then he kissed his wife fervently, opened the hatchway, and ran downstairs. When Kristen came out onto the gallery, Erland was standing in the courtyard below, helping the royal treasurer, an elderly and ponderous man, down from his saddle. There were at least 30 armed men with Sir Bard and the sheriff of Gaudela County. As Kristen walked across the courtyard, she heard the latter man say,
I bring you greetings from your cousins, Erlan. Borgar and Guttorm are enjoying the king's hospitality in Vir. And I think that Haftor Torreson has already paid a visit to Ivar and the young boy at home at Sunbu by this time. Sir Bard seized Grout yesterday morning in town.
And now you've come here to invite me to the same meeting of the royal retainers, I can see, said Erland with a smile.
That is true, Erland.
And no doubt you'll want to search the manor. Oh, I've taken part in this kind of thing so many times that I should know how it goes.
But you've never had such great matters as high treason on your hands before, said Tora.
No, not until now, said Erlan.
And it looks as if I'm playing with the black chess pieces, Tora, and you have me checkmated.
Isn't that so, kinsman?
We're looking for the letters that you've received from Lady Ingebjörg Hawken's daughter, said Tora Eindridsson.
They're in the chest, covered with red leather, up in the weapons loft. But they contained little except such greetings as loving kinsmen usually send to each other. And all of them are old. Stein here can show you the way.
The strangers had dismounted, and the servants of the estate had now come swarming into the courtyard.
There was much more than that in the one we took from Borgar Tronson, said Tora.
Erlan began whistling softly.
I suppose we might as well go into the house, he said. It's getting crowded out here.
Kristen followed the men into the hall. At a sign from Tora, a couple of the armed guards came along.
You'll have to surrender your sword, Erlan, said Tora of Gimzar when they came inside. As a sign that you're our prisoner.
Erlan slapped his flanks to show that he carried no other weapon than the dagger at his belt. But Tora repeated,
You must hand over your sword as a sign.
Well, if you want to do this formally, said Erlan, laughing a bit.
He went over and took down his sword from the peg, holding it by the sheath and offering the hilt to Tora Eindridsson with a slight bow. The old man from Gimzar loosened the fastenings, pulled the sword all the way out, and stroked the blade with a fingertip.
Was it this sword, Erlan, that you used?
Erlan's blue eyes glittered like steel. He pressed his lips together into a narrow line.
Yes, it was with this sword that I punished your grandson when I found him with my daughter.
Tora stood holding the sword. He looked down at it and said in a threatening tone,
You, who were supposed to uphold the law, Erlan, you should have known then that you were going farther than the law would follow you.
Erlan threw back his head, his eyes blazing and fierce.
There is a law, Tora, that cannot be subverted by sovereigns or tings, which says that a man must protect the honor of his women with the sword. You've been fortunate, Erlan Nikolausen, that no man has ever used that law against you, replied Tora of Gimzar, his voice full of malice. Or you might have needed as many lives as a cat.
Erlan's response was infuriatingly slow.
Isn't the present undertaking serious enough that you would think it inopportune to bring up those old charges from my youth? I don't know whether Bard of Lensvik would consider them old charges.
Rage surged up inside Erlan, and he was about to reply, but Tora shouted,
You ought to find out first, Erlan, whether your paramours are so clever that they can read, before you run around on your nightly adventures with secret letters in your belt. Just ask Bard who it was that warned us you were planning treachery against your king, to whom you've sworn loyalty and who granted you the position of sheriff.
Involuntarily, Erlan pressed a hand to his breast. For a moment he glanced at his wife, and the blood rushed to his face. Then Kristen ran forward and threw her arms around his neck. Erlan looked down into her face. He saw nothing but love in her eyes.
Erlan, husband!
The royal treasurer had remained largely silent. Now he went over to the two of them and said softly,
My dear mistress, perhaps it would be best if you took the children and the serving women with you into the women's house and stayed there as long as we're here at the manor.
Erlan let go of his wife with one last squeeze of his arm around her shoulder.
It would be best, my dear Kristen. Do as Sir Bard advises.
Kristen stood on her toes and offered Erlan her lips. Then she went out into the courtyard and collected her children and serving women from among the crowd, taking them with her into the little house. There was no other women's house at Husaby. They sat there for several hours. The composure of their mistress kept the frightened group more or less calm. Then Erlan entered, bearing no weapons and dressed for travel. Two strangers stood guard at the door. He shook hands with his eldest sons and then lifted the smallest ones into his arms while he asked where Galta was.
Well, you must give him my greetings, Nakva. He must have gone off into the woods with his bow the way he usually does. Tell him he can have my English longbow after all, the one I refused to give him last Sunday.
Kristen pulled him to her without speaking a word. Then she whispered urgently,
When are you coming back, Erlan, my friend?
When God wills it, my wife.
She stepped back, struggling not to break down. Normally, he never addressed her in any other way except by using her given name. His last words had shaken her to the heart. Only now did she fully understand what had happened. At sunset, Kristen was sitting up on the hill north of the manor. She had never before seen the sky so red and gold. Above the opposite ridge stretched an enormous cloud. It was shaped like a bird's wing, glowing from within like iron in the forge, and gleaming brightly like amber. Small golden shreds like feathers tore away and floated into the air. And far below, on the lake at the bottom of the valley, spread a mirror image of the sky and the cloud and the ridge. Down in the depths, the radiant blaze was flaring upward, covering everything in sight. The grass in the meadows had grown tall, and the silky tassels of the straw shone dark red beneath the crimson light from the sky. The barley had sprouted spikes and caught the light on the young, silky, smooth awn. The sod-covered rooftops of the farm buildings were thick with sorrel and buttercups, and the sun lay across them in wide bands. The blackened shingles of the church roof gleamed darkly, and its light-colored stone walls were becoming softly gilded. The sun broke through from beneath the cloud, perched on the mountain rim, and lit up one forested ridge after another. It was such a clear evening. The light opened up vistas to small hamlets amidst the spruce-decked slopes. She could make out mountain pastures and tiny farms in among the trees that she had never been able to see before from Husaby. The shapes of huge mountains rose up, reddish-violet, in the south toward Dovre, in places that were usually covered by haze and clouds. The smallest bell down in the church began to ring, and the church bell at Vinyar answered. Kristen sat bowed over her folded hands until the last notes of the ninefold peal died away. Now the sun was behind the ridge, the golden glow paled and the crimson grew softer and pinker. After the ringing of the bells had ceased, the rustling sound from the forest swelled and spread again. The tiny creek trickling through the leafy woods down in the valley sounded louder. From the pasture nearby came the familiar clinking of the livestock bells. A flying beetle buzzed halfway around her and then disappeared. She sent a last sigh after her prayers, an appeal for forgiveness because her thoughts had been elsewhere while she prayed. The beautiful large estate lay below her on the hillside, like a jewel on the wide bosom of the slope. She gazed out across all the land she had owned along with her husband. Thoughts about the manor and its care had filled her soul to the brim. She had worked and struggled. Not until this evening did she realize how much she had struggled to put this estate back on its feet and keep it going, how hard she had tried, and how much she had accomplished. She had accepted it as her fate, to be born with patience and a straight back, that this had fallen to her. Just as she had striven to be patient and steadfast no matter what life presented, every time she learned she was carrying yet another child under her breast, again and again. With each son added to the flock, she recognized that her responsibility had grown for ensuring the prosperity and secure position of the lineage. Tonight she realized that her ability to survey everything at once and her watchfulness had also grown with each new child entrusted to her care. Never had she seen it so clearly as on this evening. What destiny had demanded of her, and what it had given her in return with her seven sons. Over and over again, joy had quickened the beat of her heart. Fear on their behalf had rent it in two. They were her children, these big sons with their lean, bony boys' bodies, just as they had been when they were small and so plump that they barely hurt themselves when they tumbled down on their way between the bench and her knee. They were hers, just as they had been back when she lifted them out of the cradle to her milk-filled breast and had to support their heads, which wobbled on their frail necks the way a bluebell nods on its stalk. Wherever they ended up in the world, wherever they journeyed, forgetting their mother, she thought that for her, their lives would be like a current in her own life. They would be one with her, just as they had been when she alone on this earth knew about the new life hidden inside, drinking from her blood and making her cheeks pale. Over and over she had endured the sinking, sweat-dripping anguish when she realized that once again her time had come. Once again she would be pulled under by the groundswell of birth pains, until she was lifted up with a new child in her arms. How much richer and stronger and braver she had become with each child was something that she first realized tonight. And yet she now saw that she was the same Kristen from Jorungarde, who had never learned to bear an unkind word because she had been protected all her days by such a strong and gentle love. In Erlan's hands, she was still the same. Yes. 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 It was true that all this time she had remembered, year after year, every wound he had ever caused her, even though she had always known that he never wounded her the way a grown person intends harm to another, but rather the way a child strikes out playfully at his companion. Each time he offended her, she had tended to the memory the way one tends to a venomous sore. And with each humiliation he brought upon himself by acting on any impulse he might have, it struck her like the lash of a whip against her flesh, causing a suppurating wound. It wasn't true that she willfully or deliberately harbored ill feelings toward her husband. She knew she wasn't usually narrow-minded, but with him she was. If Erland had a hand in it, she forgot nothing, and even the smallest scratch on her soul would continue to sting and bleed and swell and ache, as if he was the one to cause it. About him, she would never be wiser or stronger. She might strive to seem capable and fearless, pious and strong in her marriage with him, but in truth, she wasn't.
Always, always there was the yearning lament inside her. She wanted to be his Kristen from the woods of Gerderud. Back then, she would have done everything she knew was wrong and sinful rather than lose him. To bind Erland to her, she had given him all that she possessed, her love and her body, her honor, and her share of God's salvation. And she had given him anything else she could find to give, her father's honor and his faith in his child, everything that grown and clever men had built up to protect an innocent little maiden if she should fall. She had set her love against their plans for the welfare and progress of her lineage, against their hopes for the fruit of their labors after they themselves lay buried. She had put at risk much more than her own life in this game, in which the only prize was the love of Erland Nikolausen. And she had won. She had known from the first time he kissed her in the garden of Hofvin until he kissed her today in the little house, before he was escorted from his home as a prisoner. Erland loved her as dearly as his own life. And if he had not counseled her well, she had known from the first moment she met him how he had counseled himself. If he had not always treated her well, he had nonetheless treated her better than he did himself. Jesus, how she had won him. She admitted it to herself tonight. She had driven him to break their marriage vows with her own coldness and poisonous words. She now admitted to herself that even during those years when she had looked on his unseemly flirting with that woman Suniva with resentment, she had also felt, in the midst of her rancor, an arrogant and spiteful joy. No one knew of any obvious stain on Suniva Olav's daughter's reputation, and yet Erland talked and jested with her like a hired man with an alehouse maid. About Kristen, he knew that she could lie and betray those who trusted her most, that she could be willingly lured to the worst of places, and yet he had trusted her. He had honored her as best he could. As easily as he forgot his fear of sin, as easily as he had finally broken his promise to God before the church door, he had still grieved over his sins against her. He had struggled for years to keep his promises to her. She had chosen him herself. She had chosen him in an ecstasy of passion, and she had chosen him again each day during those difficult years back home at Durengard, his impetuous passion in place of her father's love, which would not allow even the wind to touch her harshly. She had refused the destiny that her father had wished for her when he wanted to put her into the arms of a man who would have safely led her onto the most secure paths, even bending down to remove every little pebble that she might tread upon. She had chosen to follow the other man, whom she knew traveled on dangerous paths. Monks and priests had pointed out remorse and repentance as the road home to peace. But she had chosen strife rather than give up her precious sin. So there was only one thing left for her. She could not lament or complain over whatever might now befall her at this man's side. It made her dizzy to think how long ago she had left her father. But she saw his beloved face and remembered his words on that day in the smithy when she stabbed the last knife into his heart. She remembered how they talked together up on the mountain that time when she realized that death's door stood open behind her father. It was shameful to complain about the fate she had chosen herself. Holy Olav, help me, so that I do not now prove myself unworthy of my father's love. Erland. Erland. When she met him in her youth, life became for her like a roiling river rushing over cliffs and rocks. During these years at Husaby, life had expanded outward, becoming wide and spacious like a lake, mirroring everything around her. She remembered back home when the log overflowed in the spring, stretching wide and gray and mighty along the valley floor, carrying with it drifting logs, and the crowns of the trees that stood rooted to the bottom would rock in the water. In the middle appeared small, dark, menacing eddies, where the current ran rough and wild and dangerous beneath the smooth surface. Now she knew that her love for Erland had rushed like a turbulent and dangerous current through her life for all these years. Now it was carrying her outward. She didn't know where.
Erlon, dear friend.
Once again, Kristen spoke the words of a prayer to the Virgin into the red of the evening. Hail Mary, full of grace.